Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
A lot of us dream for someone to send us a check or a large, huge lump sum of cash to be used as we see fit. In the early 70s, an eccentric 21-year-old millionaire actually made promises to share his wealth with anyone who asked. A new documentary, Dear Mr. Brody, streaming on Discovery Plus, tells the story of a young Michael Brody, the heir to a margarine fortune, when he invited hundreds of thousands of people to write him letters to just ask for money, say what they needed and why. Let's listen to some footage featured in the film of Michael Brody explaining why he wanted to share his wealth.
Well, I personally think that maybe I'll be setting a new trend. Like, I think if people like Onassis or the Kennedys or some of these people use some of their money and give to the poor, and if everybody just gave $1 million, if every millionaire gave $1 million to one foundation and said, look, let's really go into this and let's really get the poor, let's get food to the poor.
He was made famous instantly, even appearing on The Ed Sullivan Show, where he sang Bob Dylan's You Ain't Going Nowhere. Unfortunately, the young millionaire committed suicide at age 24, and most of the letters remained unopened. That is until filmmaker Keith Maitland and his crew unearthed thousands of thoughtful letters mailed to Michael Brody and his wife, Renee Brody, who was also featured in the film. Through these letters, we look into a portrait of late 60s and early 70s America and catch a glimpse of people's hopes, dreams, and challenges at that time. A New York Times review says, Dear Mr. Brody nods to and teases the era's psychedelic tendencies. And joining us today to talk about the film is filmmaker Keith Maitland. He is a director and producer who is also known for the Critics' Choice Award-winning film Towers about the 1966 University of Texas shooting in 2016, and the Emmy-nominated The Eyes of Me, A Year in the Life of Four Blind Teens in 2009. Keith, thank you for joining us, and welcome to all of it.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
What was your reaction when you first started to open these letters, even when you first heard about these letters? It's an amazing story.
Well, you know, I think I've always grown up enamored of the idea of like this perfect time capsule, you know, the concept that somebody had squirreled away all these incredible thoughts and ephemeral ideas and locked them away to time only to be open to some great fanfare, you know, years and years later. And when Melissa Glassman, who discovered these letters in a storage locker in L.A., after almost 50 years, first told me and my wife, Sarah Wilson, and our producing partner, Megan Gilbride, all about this, this trove of letters, that idea of this perfect time capsule just kind of, felt like it appeared right before our eyes.
Yeah. I mean, most of these letters were never opened. Why did this whole thing get started? Why did Michael Brody vow to give away so much money, all of his money?
Yeah. Well, you know, Michael was a true child of the 60s. You know, you have to remember this whole story went down in January of 1970. So just less than 6 months before all this, both Michael and Renee were both at Woodstock. They were both, you know, kind of products of that time, but they didn't know each other yet. Michael and Renee met at a party in Scarsdale in December of 69. And on the night they met, Michael fell in love and proposed. And Renee said yes. And 3 weeks later, they were sitting on a beach in Jamaica on their honeymoon. And I think they felt this incredible sense of true love. They felt incredibly privileged by having found each other and the blue skies above and the ocean waves lapping at the beach at their feet. And suddenly this idea occurred to Michael. We don't need all this money. What we need is world peace. What we need is for people to know love like we've discovered. And that's kind of where this was all born.
Let's listen to a clip from the film. In this one, we're going to hear the daughters of Jacqueline Badger, who wrote a letter to Michael asking for funding to start her typewriting business. The producers asked them to read their letter on camera.
This is East Harlem, El Barrio. There's many names.
Spanish Harlem, El Barrio, Washington Projects.
This is where we live. This is where it all started for me. I was born in this building, basically. And we lived here for 35 years.
I need $100 and 10 new Remington Rand typewriters, standard office size preferred, and other supplies so that I can teach typing to residents of East Harlem, so mothers can get off of welfare and work. Personally feel a commitment and duty is calling me. If I don't do it, it won't get done. I want to be a teacher more than anything else in the world. You can read.
I must be successful in my mission. I cannot accept failure or defeat. Mistakes, yes. Problems, yes. Difficulties, yes. But I refuse to give up my dream.
I hear you.
Yep, that's her. She refuses.
Some of these letters capture such personal, private moments. When the writers opened these letters from 1970, all these years later, how did it feel to connect with some of these people who had written a letter or who were perhaps reading a letter written by a relative that they, you know, had, this is something they'd never seen before?
I mean, it's an incredible feeling, to be honest with you. The project was such a tremendous volume of stories of humanity kind of reflected in these letters, that, you know, we spent years opening letters and reading and learning and understanding, and then running to Google and searching for these people to find out, you know, what became of them. Had they overcome their obstacles? You know, had they survived travails? And so by the time we finally got around to actually meeting some of the folks and putting these letters into their own hands, it was just an incredible kind of magical feeling. And across the board, every one of those instances, really, really impacted us. They really changed us. The project's been incredible, and meeting the letter writers and sharing their own words with them 50 years later, you know, is really the icing on the cake.
Were you anxious about some of those moments though? Because, you know, a lot of these letters really capture a painful time in their lives. How did you feel about them opening these letters and featuring them in the film initially?
Well, as an independent filmmaker, I'm just about always anxious because, you know, we're just, you know, throwing ourselves into the great unknown in a storytelling sense. But what was wild is we would call these folks, you know, we had read their letters and we knew that they had gone, you know, unanswered because they were, you know, truly unopened. We're opening these letters for the first time, kind of letting these voices out. And then when we'd find them, you know, through Facebook and people searches and all kinds of, you know, internet sleuthing, we would say to them, listen, we found this letter that you sent all these years ago. Do you remember sending it? And invariably, almost nobody remembered even sending the letter, let alone what they said or how they felt at the time. And then the next step would be, we'd say, well, what we want to do is we want to come visit you. And we want to give you your letter to read on camera, but we don't want to tell you what's in it until the cameras are rolling, because I think there's something to be captured in that moment. So we're asking them to take a leap of faith with us.
Yeah,
you know, that we wouldn't embarrass them or shame them in some way through the process. But that was definitely not our goal. And so, it's
clear that that's not your goal. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was really just a wonderful process. It felt like it was a long time coming. And so we were thrilled to be there.
What picture do these letters paint of Michael's legacy and the time in which they were written?
Well, I think the best thing that they say about Michael's legacy is that he invited people to kind of share their stories. You can look at it critically and say, you know, he offered to give away money and didn't give away all of his money, and he didn't give away money to these people in particular. We know that. But that's not the lens that we take when we look at this story. Myself and our whole team here, we try and see it as what it was initially intended, an opportunity to spread love and opportunity to create pathways to change in society. And so that's how we read these letters as we open them and continue to even open new old letters. We look at it as an opportunity to kind of embrace the humanity that's on display.
As you continue to open new old letters, because how many letters are we talking about total?
Well, you know, it was really hard to get a very specific count, but our estimate is approximately 32,000 letters and change is what Melissa discovered. You know, they were in this storage locker in LA owned by legendary indie producer Ed Pressman. You know, Ed had had these letters for 40 plus years. They came to him as a part of research and a rights deal to develop the Michael Brody story into a movie in the 70s. The movie never happened, but the boxes of letters remained. And Ed was prescient and wise enough to hold on to them because he saw value in them. I think also because he recognized that there was a lot of really, you know, deeply held human connections left in these envelopes. So now we've opened, I think we came to the count, we've opened about 12,000 of the letters.
Wow.
Yeah, about 1,200 of them are in the film in one way or another, either through fast-moving visuals or read by actors.
And there's some amazing visuals. There's artwork in these letters. Somebody recorded a song about Michael Brody that we get to hear in the film. There's all kinds of effort and creativity that went into these.
Yeah. And the people who really took that effort, I think, paid off, at least as far as our angle on this story, because, you know, when you're opening thousands and thousands of letters, you're just much more inclined to reach for a letter that's got a beautifully hand-rendered, you know, multicolored drawing on the outside mm-hmm. of the envelope, or a thick package that has a box or a book or a series of pamphlets or photos of their children, you know, or copies of their hospital bills. There were just, I don't know, you're absolutely right. The inclusions, that's what we came to call them. The inclusions in the letters really spoke to us, and we tried to get as much of that into the film as possible.
There's this real sense of unfinished projects that runs through this film, and unanswered letters. And you find out there's so many more letters that his son has. Michael Brody is survived by his wife, Renee, and son, Jamie. How do these two individuals view the letters that were received by Michael and this whole project, really?
Yeah, well, they have they have different points of view on it, I think. You know, for Renee, she lived through this and survived this whole story. And I think that she has to reckon with her own relationship to the loss of Michael and to this time period and to Jamie's, you know, young childhood.
You talk about surviving this whole story, because what emotional effect did receiving all these requests from hundreds of thousands of people have on Michael Brody and family?
Well, that's a good question. It's hard to know. You know, for Michael and Renee, the letters were certainly, you know, omnipresent in this time period in their lives. But even more pressure and impact were the crowds of people who showed up everywhere they went. You know, the crush of the crowds, people knocking on their door in Scarsdale, people following them down the street as they move through Manhattan. So the letters, I think, you know, take on almost a secondary role in Renee's memory of this time, you know, because the primary role were just the sea of faces, you know, and people with their hands out and people who wanted and needed help. But the pressure of that was tremendous.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and how does, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say for Jamie, which I think is what you were going to ask.
Yeah.
Jamie, it's a different relationship. You know, Jamie wasn't around as the story unfolded. He's grown up in a life that has always been aware that this happened, but has never had a really concrete handle on what it all meant. And so through the process of making the film, we've gotten to know Jamie really well, and we've gotten to hear his thoughts and opinions on all of this. And one of the most fascinating elements came when Melissa and I first met Jamie. You know, we were introduced to the story through the letters that Melissa had found. And it was very quick once we met Jamie that we realized he had
almost five times the amount of letters that Melissa found in his possession. And he had the same idea that we had, which let us know we were on the right path. He said, wouldn't it be incredible to start opening these letters and track down the people and find out what happened? So now, all these years later, the letters that we opened that Ed Pressman held on to all these years have a new home at Columbia University, where they can be accessed by the public in an exciting, living archive. And Jamie has held on to the letters that he is a steward to, this five times amount, which I can only estimate is maybe 150,000 letters. And he has hopes to read those letters, to access those letters through the years as well.
It's interesting. It's almost like he's piecing together elements of his father, the father he never really knew, through some of these letters.
Yeah. I think that's what, that's what we all do, though. We know our family stories because we live through them. And the more curious we are to ask our grandparents and our aunts and uncles, what the times were like for our family before we came along, the more we start to see a different picture of the world and of where we come from. And as we grow and we change through the years, we have a new appreciation. We see our parents in different light as we become parents. We see the world and the problems of the world, differently as we come to all see that the more things change, the more they stay the same. And that, I think, is a real message that impacted me and my team here as we made this film.
Well, as we're wrapping up here, you mentioned Melissa, and I want to finish talking about her. One of the producers, Melissa Robin Glassman, made it her mission to open all of these letters. Can you just talk for a moment as we're closing about her passion and why she felt like she had to do that?
I think the day that Melissa discovered these letters in that storage locker, I think it's a major find. And I think it was for somebody who has spent many years developing stories for movies. She has incredible instincts about storytelling and about what makes, human stories important and how to communicate those. And suddenly this one day, her life changes because she's confronted with, tens of thousands of stories, tens of thousands of narratives, many of which could and should be their own movies. And so she didn't take that lightly. And it's one of the things I respect the most about Melissa. There's many things I respect about her. But when we made this movie, she actually quit her job working for Ed Pressman to move here to Austin, Texas, where we live. To make this movie with us. And she moved into the house right next to where Sarah and I live. She lived under the same roof with these 33,000 letters.
Wow.
And when the workday would end, Sarah and I would walk back next door and make dinner for our son. But Melissa would continue to open those letters.
Wow.
I think they really do. They've become a part of her life.
Well, you can really feel her passion for this work in this film. It's a fascinating film. The documentary Dear Mr. Brody, streaming on Discovery Plus. Filmmaker Keith Maitland, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's been great talking with you. Thank you.